This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state of the art L shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoho Loon Plaza. Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Ooh, it's a wonderful temperature tonight in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Hoho Loon Plaza, the L-shaped studio. You are listening to the hard-traveling fanboys. I am Greg Phillips, and with me today is the Taraxia to my Thanos. A very ornery, shall we say, Nick Duke.
I'm not ornery.
Nick.
I'm horny. I'm not ornery. Those are two totally different things. I'm fine.
I noticed from the mirror that reflects your image on the other side of the L-shaped studio that you're not wearing pants right now.
I'm not wearing pants. Just, you know, and that's the same as every other episode we've done for like the last 2 years.
Well, nevertheless.
What of it? You got a problem with it?
I have no issues with it. I have no. Listen how ornery he is.
I'm not ornery.
Testy. He's on edge. No one knows what's going on in the Nick right now. Nick, I mean, is everything all right?
Everything's fine. Everything is fine. We're going to do the podcast. It's going to be fun.
All right. Yes. You are listening to a version of the Long Book Hunters. This is where we take a look at a trade paperback or graphic novel, collected edition, if you will, and give our analysis to it. And sometimes it will be a book that we've read before. Sometimes it'll be a book that we haven't. This week around, we're a little bit late getting to it, but we are finally getting to a pretty timely and relevant book, which is the inspiration for the number one movie so far, and one of the top grossing movies of all time at this point, Avengers: Infinity War. And the book that we're looking at tonight is from 1991, a year very near and dear to my heart. It is by Jim Starlin is the writer. George Perry and Ron Lim trade off on penciling duties on this one. And it is called simply The Infinity Gauntlet. Now, as we have talked about in the past, the original concept for this was to take a book that I've read or Nick's read and the other one hasn't. Well, in this case, we've both read The Infinity Gauntlet, but at vastly different times. To give you a little bit of background on me, I read The Infinity Gauntlet when it came out in 1991 when I was 7 years old. The reason that I read The Infinity Gauntlet was because literally everyone at school was talking about it. It was, and I've talked about this before on these here airwaves and elsewhere, The Infinity Gauntlet to my, was it first or second grade class, was like nothing I could describe from modern comics, because maybe I'm wrong, but I just don't imagine that there's a lot of playgrounds right now where kids are talking about comic book events. They're skewed towards an audience. But this was kind of in that transitional phase where comics were really reaching a wide swath of an audience. You had young kids were still reading it, but teenagers and adults were reading them as well. And in our case, at the playground, everyone was talking about this character called Thanos and this concept called the Infinity Gauntlet. And for any – and this is the ultimate legacy of this, at least for my generation. The introduction of the Infinity Gauntlet ruined games for a long time. Because anybody that used to play superheroes on the playground, there was always one kid in the group who would say, "I got the Infinity Gauntlet." And then when you try to attack him, you're turned to stone or you're evaporated or you just can't do it. Nope, Infinity Gauntlet. And it would ruin every game. But nonetheless, it was a huge happening on the playgrounds of Venice, Florida when I was a youngster. Nick, how did you first come across this storyline?
Well, I read the odd comic there when I was a kid, but it was mostly stuff that, you know, caught my eye on the newsstand or whatever, whether it was random issues of Spider-Man that guest starred the Hulk or something like that. But as we detailed on these steroids several times, I didn't really get into comics hardcore until 2002. And by that point, obviously, the Infinity Gauntlet was a decade, over a decade in the past, but it was something that, you know, had already attained this legendary status amongst Marvel. And surprisingly, it took me several years to finally get around to reading it, but I remember the when I first signed up for Marvel Unlimited, that was one of the first things I did, was finally go and read Infinity Gauntlet. And you okay over there?
Oh, I'm good. Yeah, what's going on?
Oh, nothing. Anyway, so one of the first things I did was finally go and read Infinity Gauntlet. And, you know, a lot of times we have these stories that are held up as classics of their time that don't, you know, that aren't often treated well by a rereading. Something like Crisis on Infinite Earths, for example, which is a wonderful story in its own right, but a little inaccessible to a new, more modern reader who wasn't there for the literally, like, you know, decades of buildup to it. So I think I was most surprised by this when I first encountered it at how well it held up. About how well it played to a largely uninformed reader such as myself and one who was more accustomed to the modern form of storytelling. So I can say it's one of those legendary events that even from my first reading felt like it was worthy of that status.
Indeed. So which kind of sets the stage nicely for this, because it has been, oh gosh, how long has that been now? Let's see, 10, 20, 27 years, my God, since I've read the Infinity Gauntlet.
Really? You never revisited it?
Nope, never did. I never had the trade. I read the single issues from people that would bring them to school. So I didn't actually ever own the Infinity Gauntlet, either the item itself or the comic book about it. Mm-hmm. So, I never did revisit it. And when I got back into comics, going back and rereading things that I'd already read when I was a kid wasn't really a high priority for me. So, but getting to this finally, this is one that I have wanted to read, but I could never find it on a good sale. So getting to read it this time around was a really fun experience for me. And I'm getting to go back and see how much of it I remembered, which, full disclosure, was very little. I remembered the bare bones of this storyline. You remember the big moments, the come and get me cover. You know, you remember the iconic cover to the first issue.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't even remember that come and get me cover. Like, I think I've seen that image in various places, but because of the usage of the word bubble, I had always assumed that it was just a interior piece of art. And so for me, the image that always stuck out was that first cover, which even before I read the story, I read the story, I knew that cover inside and out. And I actually have a poster of it on my wall just because it's a beautiful, it's a beautiful cover and one of the most gripping things you'll ever see.
Yes. Yes. It's an iconic cover, but I remember the covers. I remember certain moments, from the story. Like, of course, the moment when Thanos finally vanquished America and all the heroes have fallen essentially. And, you know, I remembered the encounter of Captain America and Thanos, and how it's this mortal man standing up against a god, basically. But I didn't remember the details. I didn't remember all of the players. I knew Adam Warlock played a big role in it. I remember the Silver Surfer played a big role in it. I didn't remember the roles of characters like Doctor Strange or the Hulk or even someone like Quasar or the celestial cosmic entities from Marvel. But basically, this was a good chance to go back through memory lane and refresh myself on this almost as a new reader and dropping myself into the way things were in Marvel Comics 1991. So sit back, relax, folks. We're going to take you back to a time of Owen Hart and Coco Beware wearing parachute pants, to a time of the Iraqi sympathizer Sergeant Slaughter defending his championship against the immortal Hulk Hogan. We're going to take you back to a year
and failing spectacularly, by the way.
Yes, alongside Colonel Mustafa, of course, General Adnan.
General Adnan,
and we're going to take you back to a year in which the man that dominated the music charts wore checkerboard shirts buttoned up and tucked into jeans. It was a great time. It was a good time. It was 1991, ladies and gentlemen. And let's get right into this. So Jim Starlin is the creator, the molder of Thanos. And one could make the argument that he has, at least for the modern era, an almost unprecedented relationship with his creation. Because if you really think about it, Nick, Thanos is a character that Jim Starlin has managed to mold from his inception, from every major event in Thanos' history up until recent years has been guided by Jim Starlin. Yeah,
you know, that's crazy. I mean, you say that, and I know that's correct. But one thing we should probably mention, and before we get too far off the topic of context, I must mention that while I have read the Infinity Gauntlet itself, I have never read any of the build up to it, nor the fallout from
it. Me either.
So all this work you're going to reference here with that Starlin did with Thanos over what I know is a 15-year period or something like that.
Yeah,
I've never read any of it.
Me either.
It's very high on my to-do list now that I have you know, I think this was my third read-through of Infinity Gauntlet, and it's kind of held up better and better each time. It's high on my to-do list, and it's something I'm looking forward to getting to eventually over on the Marvel Age podcast, but I wasn't there for any of it, or I haven't been on that journey, so it's hard to know what exactly it is that Starlin did with Thanos other than, I mean, do it notable under the sun. He's basically been under, up until very recently anyway, it's only ever been Starlin that's written him.
Absolutely. It's really rare in comics to find a level of a relationship, particularly between a creator and a villain, but a creator and a character in general. So Thanos pops up first in The Invincible Iron Man number 55 in 1973, and he pops up pretty frequently as a foil for the Avengers, for Iron Man, for Spider-Man a couple times, for various characters, and finds himself in conflict with the Avengers over items of, in particular, the Cosmic Cube. So over time, after he's foiled in his plans to dominate the universe with the Cosmic Cube, Thanos finds himself at some point dead. Alongside Adam Warlock and Captain Marvel, or Mar-Vell. So, as Thanos is dead, and this is in the build-up to Infinity Gauntlet, he is resurrected by Mistress Death, the living embodiment of death in the Marvel Universe. This is a trope that pretty much DC and Marvel both have, where they have these living embodiments of abstract concepts. And in this case, Death is a woman, and she resurrects Thanos and orders him with restoring balance to the universe by wiping half of life. Well, as we find out in the Infinity Gauntlet in the flashback sequence, Thanos has manipulated this situation and used it as an excuse to go and seek out the Infinity Stones, or the Infinity Gems, as they're called here, which apparently had been brought up in part of Star's Cosmic Saga earlier when they were known as the Soul Gems. So he goes out and he finds these soul gems or infinity gems and constructs the Infinity Gauntlet. And all you need to know basically going into this is that each of these six stones controls a different element of the universe. And if you can wield them all together with this Infinity Gauntlet, you have absolute power. That's right. You don't have the gauntlet. You don't have the Enforcer or Magnum Force or Dirty Harry. You have absolute power. And with that absolute power, do anything you want, basically. With a snap of his fingers, Thanos can control everything. And that's really where we start out in this story.
Mm-hmm. It's very much like the movie in that regard where – well, let me rephrase. The movie and this differ a little bit in that – in the movie, we actually get to see Thanos go on the journey of collecting all the stones, but yet there is still an element in the movie of stuff has happened, you know, off panel or off screen. You know, he's gotten the Power Stone before he ever gets on, before the movie begins. Here, he's got the entire gauntlet. He is ready to roll by the time this book opens. And so that's one of the reasons I'm looking forward to going back and reading the build to it and see just how tough that struggle was to try and keep that out of his hands.
and his continuing, direction with Mistress Death. So, yeah, definitely, it differs from the movie in that regard. How it's similar to the movie is really how it begins. It opens up, and Thanos has already obtained absolute power, and he even has his own sycophant. If you've seen the movie Infinity War, his sycophant is the Ebony Maw. And the Ebony Maw basically walks around and just, in Paul Heyman-like fashion, just gloats about how dominant and how powerful and how magnificent and noble Thanos is. Well, here, Thanos' sycophant is Paul Heyman, portrayed by a pretty major Marvel villain, Nick, in Mephisto.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. Again, it's one of those things that makes me more intrigued to see like how that dynamic developed, because most of the times I've encountered Mephisto, it has been a big bad in his own right. Whether it be with, for example, we saw him in Black Panther, the Chris Priest run that we recently encountered. Obviously, he plays a major role in the One More Day story that I've talked about so many times on these airwaves. He's a big foil for Ghost Rider throughout the year. So yeah, that was interesting to me to see him here in a lackey role as opposed to being the featured guy.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And it actually helps because right out of the gate, it's establishing what a big deal this Infinity Gauntlet is and what a big deal Thanos now is, because you've got this normally powerful, prideful, egotistical villain who is stuffing down his ego so much that he's literally a kiss ass for Thanos. And you have to realize that there's a reason he's doing this, and he is terrified of Thanos. And if Mephisto himself is scared, you know that this is a big, big, high stakes deal. So here's the other thing about this story that was reading it, and I'm sure I can speak for you on this as well, Nick. Neither one of us really has any idea what the Avengers are at this point, and what the state of the Marvel Universe is at this point.
No.
You see, in 1991, I was reading X-Men and Spider-Man comics. Mm-hmm. I did not touch an Avengers comic until later on, much, much later on. I didn't touch any of the individual Avengers themselves titles until much later on. So I was completely a novice when it comes to Captain America and that whole side of things. But apparently, from what we can gather, Nick, and you can help me fill in on this if you pick up anything that I'm leaving out here, but at the time of the Infinity Gauntlet, you've got two different Avengers groups, it appears. Avengers West Coast.
Yes, this is during the time of the West Coast Avengers, which is one of those critically acclaimed runs that seems like it was something runs to the success DC was having with Justice League International. In terms of a more comedy-focused offshoot of their big super team. And, of course, you had the main Avengers team, which I'm not exactly sure what the membership was at that point, but I do know that they still had Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, you know, the big three, so to speak, amongst their ranks. And they were going with the take on the Avengers, not unlike something like what we saw in Justice League Unlimited, where you had the core team, but then you also had tons of affiliate members. At the end point in the story, we see Captain America showing computer screens of all the different Avengers affiliate members or reserve members or whatever who have been taken out by Thanos. So,
yes.
That seems to be what the status quo of the team was at this point.
Which includes people like Beast, who is an ancillary member of the Avengers at this point, or maybe even a major member. I don't know.
I think all of the Fantastic Four were actually shown on that screen as well.
She-Hulk, Cersei, which I had to get a crash course on Cersei from my boss this morning. He is a fan of Marvel from that era and the Avengers books in particular. And so he was filling me in on Cersei. She was a big member of the Avengers at this point. You have Hawkeye, who also was in the West Coast contingent. You have got people like the Black Knight. You've got then on the West Coast, you've got Scarlet Witch. You've got
Vision.
I think he was with the main. And I say that because there was a shot of Scarlet Witch coming through the portal from the West Coast and him embracing her when she does. So I feel like he was in the main group, but I could be wrong. Okay. But you have Wonder Man was on the West Coast for sure.
Well, then who kept calling him Viz then throughout the entire book? Was it Scarlet Witch?
Scarlet Witch calls him Viz, and Black Widow calls him Viz. Black Widow is also on the main Avengers team. So it's kind of an interesting time. The Hulk is not on the Avengers. The Hulk, as we learned in the book, has exiled from the Avengers based on his criminal activities in recent years. I'm assuming that this is right on the heels of when he was the Joe Fixit, or the Gray Hulk, which is a complicated story that I'll get into off the air with Nick at some point. But this is the sentient talking Hulk, but he appears to maybe be a hybrid with Bruce Banner, but he doesn't also appear to be a scientist Hulk yet. He is he's wearing regular clothes and talking like a tough guy completely coherently. So don't really know or remember what the deal was with that, but not necessarily my favorite version of the Hulk, Nick.
No, mine either. On the topic of not necessarily favorite versions of characters, let's go ahead and get this out of the way. Fucking Eric Masterson. Fuck him right in the ass.
Yes, because the Mighty Thor in this story is not the traditional I don't even know how to explain this, Nick. He is not Thor Odinson, right? He is the but he's not, and he's not Donald Blake. He is an individual named Eric Masterson, and when he turns into Thor, he gets the powers of Thor, but not the identity of Thor, right? Right?
Yes. So basically, Eric Masterson was something that you know, there for a long time, Marvel kind of did away with the whole Donald Blake thing, and they just had Thor be Thor. Like, for example, when we read some of the Simonson stuff, you noted one of my favorite aspects was Sigurd Jarlsson, which was Thor's civilian identity. But he, you know, if Donald Blake were still a thing, he wouldn't need to take on a civilian identity. You know what I mean? So they got away with the whole dual personality thing. And then at some point, for whatever reason, they decided to come back to it. But instead of going back to Donald Blake and that pre-existing history and the somewhat complex character they had developed him into, what with, you know, he was a guy who struggled with self-esteem issues because of his physical handicap, and yet simultaneously was one of the most ego-driven characters in the entire Marvel Universe, so it had this cool character dichotomy about it. They decided to replace Donald Blake with just one of the most generic characters in the history of comics, Eric, as you call him, Masterson, who first met Thor when there was some kind of fight at a construction site or something, and then, like, he accidentally got hurt, and so Thor felt bad, and, you know, it was one of these things where, you know, it didn't really make any sense what was going on. And eventually, in order to save his life, Thor wound up bonding his powers to the body of Eric Masterson. And so Thor was no longer a thing. Instead, he was Thor inside of Eric Masterson. But then Eric Masterson was no longer around because Thor had taken over his body. And so they got Heimdall to, like, create the separation between the two using the hammer, kind of the way they did with Donald Blake, so that both could live lives. But then something about it didn't work, and so, like, Masterson never fully gave over to the Thor personality. He just had all of Thor's powers, and instead of owning this to the rest of the Marvel Universe and admitting it to the Avengers, he was trying to, like, lie and play it off as if he were the actual Thor, even though he wasn't. And none of that makes any sense.
It's all quite boring, Basil.
Yes.
But yes, he's lying to the rest of the Avengers, which you find out through internal monologue here. Not unlike, and I can actually relate to the story, Nick, because at the same time, DC was doing a similar storyline with a character named Bloodwind that ended up being Martian Manhunter in disguise.
Yes.
And he was lying to all of his fellow Avengers about being this character called Bloodwind.
Yes, but wasn't
later on there was an actual Bloodwind.
But wasn't the case there that, like, even we as readers did not know that it was a character called Bloodwind?
Yes, that is correct.
So whereas here, we have this information that the other characters don't, and it makes us hate this douchebag as a result of having that information.
And I've always been very, like, unclear. I mean, I'll be honest, Nick. One element of Thor I've never liked is the Donald Blake thing. You know that. I've never liked that. And in this case, it's much worse because you've got you know, like you just said, it's very convoluted. But nonetheless, that's the status. That's Thor. You don't really need to know anything more than that. He's Thor. Whatever. He's Eric Masterson. He's Thor in this story. And then you have what other prominent differences might you have noticed among characters here? Ah, the Vision is all white. I'm sorry. No, let me take that back. I was wrong. I misspoke. The Vision is all white.
White, yes.
At this time.
This is the version of the costume I was actually first introduced to.
Yes, through the video game.
Captain America and the Avengers, the video game, where I just called him Mothman for some reason. Because to me, that's what he looked like. When I was a kid, I didn't know what else to call him. Because I didn't know what the Vision was. Like, I had never heard of the Vision before. And I have to say, after reading a bit more comics, I greatly prefer the red and green and yellow costume.
I don't know. I can go either way. I don't know. For some reason, I'm still fond of the all-white look. Mm. Now, the one thing I will say about the all-white look, I've always preferred it probably because it was my first Vision as well through the video game. But I will say that it did, because of the coloring limitations of the time, he does look too similar to Silver Surfer, in my opinion, mm-hmm. in this story. There's too much repetition with there. And
because of the coloring limitations of the time, he never actually looks white. He looks like dingy. Yes. Oh, and it's not a good look.
Right. He looks like
I'm sure with glossy pages now, they could probably pull off the look very well if they ever chose to go back to it. But in this era, like, I understand what they were trying to – they just – like, literally, the technology wasn't there. It's weird as it's to say about a color, you know?
Right, right. Well, and I will say this. I'm not a big fan of the original Vision costume. Controversial comment.
Oh, wow.
But I will say it looks great in live action. I love what they've done with it in the movies. I just never thought it looked cool in the comics. Nonetheless, he's a white, pale – really an off-white, actually, Nick, if you think about it.
An eggnog-colored Vision.
Yes, an eggnog individual here. So Scarlet Witch is on
West Coast. I don't think there are any other substances besides eggnog that have this particular color.
Let me think about that. Any substances that could be caused by Orton appearances in the SummerSlam live chat that we have going on for Place to Be Nation.
Or any substances that Sex Ferguson might pump out behind the food line. Could several, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Unfortunately, we can't come up with it right now.
It's semen. That's the joke.
I was going to make a summa cum laude joke there, but I guess that would be too inside.
Summa comes so very loud.
Or sometimes not at all. Anyway, we apologize. That was unnecessary.
We are full of it tonight.
But what do you call it? I have a track of what. Oh yeah, another difference is Black Widow has the short hair.
We are spiraling down the rabbit hole here. Let's veer back on top.
Yes. Yes. Anyway, so also, my gosh, maybe I've just never noticed it. Has Black Widow's costume had a very obvious Black Widow on the costume?
Yes.
I've never noticed it. I swear I've never noticed it. I guess I've just never looked hard enough.
I mean, every classic incarnation of the costume anyway. Like, I think it's something that's been done away with in moderns, but
yeah. I guess that's the problem is, again, I have so little exposure to Avengers comics. Like, this was like a crash course in Avengers stuff for me because I'm so unfamiliar. So anyway, at this time, the Avengers also have alliances with, you know, individuals such as the Titans, who are Thanos' siblings, and indeed his father, the Mentor. We meet them. I don't know jack squat about the Titans, Nick.
Comes off like a low-rent
Inhumans?
High Father.
Oh yeah, the new gods.
Yeah, it comes off like a low rent version of the New Gods, which
is appropriate.
Which, to be fair, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, come on. I mean, you got Thanos. You know, you got the
Dark Side.
You know, you got the High Father. You got the Mentor. The Mentor.
You got the Orion. You got the Eros. You know, there's some spheres, all I'm saying.
Yeah, similarities, yeah.
Although there is no dumb character in the New Gods like Drax, who was awesome here, by the way.
Oh, Drax is great. Totally different. Totally different. This is so weird, Nick. totally different than how he's presented in the movie, but also totally different than how he was presented in that Guardians of the Galaxy volume that we read.
Yeah, in that first volume of the Abnett and Lanning stuff. Yeah, I would agree. And even totally different from a costumes perspective too. I would argue that Abnett and Lanning, or who had designed on that in between this and that, man, they knocked it out of the park, because
yes,
not a great look, yes, for Drax the Destroyer back in 91.
No. Apparently, this was still in the era of the really high collared capes,
mm-hmm,
which were popular
and bizarre head coverings that made no sense.
Yes, but nevertheless, Drax is an idiot here, but a lovable idiot. He's such an idiot that one of my favorite scenes of the last issue, Nick, is he puts Hulk in a chokehold for no reason. And Hulk has to tell him, "You idiot, I'm on your team." Oh, that's good stuff. So yes, Drax is good here. He is here. Nebula is completely different than she is in the movies. My first exposure, by the way, ever to Nebula, at least since I read this as a kid in the comics, was this. Much, much different here. Here she is the grander Thanos.
Or what about Gamora and how different she is as well?
Yes, and I'll go one further on Gamora. I'm still not entirely sure
who she is, what
she was doing there, or how that whole thing worked.
The implication is that she was just shacking up with Adam Warlock and Pip the Troll in a hotel room for no adequately explained reason. That's what I got out of it anyway.
I'm guessing that they were all in the Soul World, and Adam Warlock sent them from the Soul World to inhabit the bodies of these deceased robbers.
Yes. Speaking of Pip the Troll, by the way, the next big DC Marvel crossover I need in my life after rereading this is definitely Pip the Troll and Detective Number One.
Yes, absolutely. Did you notice the little bit from I'm guessing George Perez was still drawing that issue, when they gather the heroes up and Wolverine first shows up, and then it's a little thing in the background, but Pip the Troll is handing Wolverine a light for his cigarette. Which was appropriate, because every scene that we see Pip in, he's smoking, and Wolverine is the first person to encounter him and seem to get on with him.
Now, see, that's a little weird, though. Explain this to me as someone who read X-Men comics a long time. I've always known Wolverine as a cigar, so it was a little jarring to see him smoking a cigarette here.
He did both. He was more of a cigar. He was more of a cigar guy, but he did both. It depended on the artist.
Okay.
Some artists drew him with cigarettes or cigars, and some drew him with the thick Nick Fury cigar.
Well, as you know, Greg, anyone who smokes cigars is inherently cooler than other people.
Right. Or anyone who smokes cigars.
I know this is coming. Let's see if this is what I think it is. Go ahead.
No, I don't think it is. Talks and cliches. I'm just referring to Nick Fury in this one. He's very very gruff, very
and look a lot like David Hasselhoff, because I think they were still tied to that movie at the time.
No, that was years later.
He looks a little bit like the Hoff.
No, I was seeing Charlton Heston the whole time, personally.
Charlton Heston.
Yeah. Look at him and tell me – look at a picture of Charlton Heston. It's not what Nick Fury looks like in this story.
I don't know.
But where did you think I was going, Nick? I'm curious now.
I thought you were going to make fun of those cigars by saying they also smoked douchey pipes, but that's neither here nor there.
No, we don't see any pipes in this story, but we do see a lot of Doctor Strange,
We see any pipes, but do we see any pikes? Specifically, any stinger pikes? Yes, no?
Pipes.
Never mind.
Anyhow, Doctor Strange here, Nick, has a not the traditional Doctor Strange mustache and goatee, right? A handlebar mustache.
Which is awesome. More people should have handlebar mustaches. They're often worn by the greatest people who have ever lived.
And in this case, it was off-putting to me every time I saw it, I have to say. I was like, why is this man, why is Doctor Strange talk? Well, it would be one thing if he had the handlebar mustache and he talked normal, but he talks in this like boring Doctor Strange way, you know, like.
You hate Doctor Strange.
I don't hate Doctor – well, okay, maybe I'm coming to the conclusion that perhaps I do. But Doctor Strange in can serve a very valuable purpose. But you have to admit, Nick, Doctor Strange has to talk in a very boring manner in order to get across what he's doing.
I don't find what he's doing has to be boring most of the time.
Oh, by the hoary eyes of Hogarth or whatever the hell, or Hogoth. And he's
the hoary, the hoary hosts of Hogarth.
Hogarth, whatever. Hogwarts, I don't know. But it's just all this gobbledygook, and he's
yes, you are so funny to me because like we you and I will sit here and accept anything Green Lantern related, yes, that DC throws at us.
Or Thor related.
But the first time Doctor Strange says something mildly ridiculous, you're like, oh God, how stupid.
We're fun of Green Lantern stuff all the time. We make fun of all the dumb stuff they've done, and I'm telling you, hoary eyes of Hogarth, which I probably
hoary
got
wrong. Hoary hosts of Hogarth.
Is a stupid thing to say. And it's just like when I would make fun of Cyclops for saying Mister. You know, it's dumb. But nonetheless, so he talks in this way and, you know, it's a shall and must and
all
that.
You, of all people, you would probably have Thor not say, I say thee nay, or
oh,
have
that's
at
ridiculous.
Thee.
No.
You would probably do away with that if you had your druthers.
No, you don't know. Get my druthers, I'll have you know. I keep my druthers locked away safely in a lockbox.
I know more about your druthers than you'd forgotten.
You're thinking of Sally Druthers, the star of nothing.
Good Lord, where are we right now? What are we doing?
The
Infinity Gauntlet. We're talking about Sally Druthers. We're supposed to be reviewing the goddamn Infinity Gauntlet.
Doctor Strange and Thor, Thor talks in a humorously over-the-top manner. Doctor Strange seems to talk in a
How can you hear the hoary hog and not think that it's over-the-top?
It is over-the-top, I'll grant you that. But you have to put it in context of everything else he says, which is generic hero 101 stuff.
I disagree, sir.
But nonetheless, Doctor Strange is here. And he does do cool stuff, admittedly. He does cool spells and whatnot and serves a porpoise here. And we see Wong, a very thinner version of Wong than you may be used to if you're familiar with the movies. But basically, 1991 in the universe is an interesting place, quite frankly. We get to meet all the cosmic entities, Epoch, Quasar, his champion, who goes by the awesome name, Nick, of Wiven, as you know. You just get to see all these interesting characters, and importantly, the great Adam Warlock, who I will say, Nick, I was this is the one element of this story that I was nervous about, because at times I've worried in the early issues that Adam Warlock was going to be this really annoying kind of like overpowered, right word, but like a John Cena-like figure.
Yeah, I mean, like he clearly knows more than everybody else, but he takes every opportunity to remind everyone that he knows more than everybody else, and not in an entertaining fashion, just in a man, this guy is pompous fashion.
Right.
And
but I think
as someone who has no other exposure to Adam, kind of went, man, this is
douche, exactly. But I think I would argue, Nick, that perhaps I think that's what saves it for me, because I think there's enough of an internal, not conflict, but there's enough nuance to his character to suggest that he is not wholly good, to suggest that he is not this like champion of morality in the way that Captain America would be, that he is, you know, he's a flawed entity. In other words, and Silver Surfer even alludes to this about how Adam Warlock appears to not really have much regard for life. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting how cold he is in the face of seeing these entire civilizations and universes wiped out, which is a good segue to the entire point of this thing, which is utter and total annihilation and destruction. It's Thanos using the universe as a thing to impress a woman. Nick, haven't we all been there?
Destroying the universe to impress a woman? No,
yes.
I haven't gotten quite that far. But however, I have often destroyed my own moral code and personality to impress a woman. So there's that at least.
Yes, as we've all, I think, at some point or another.
Yes.
But Thanos does that here, and he is when he was resurrected by his death, he developed a fascination, dare I say it, Nick, an obsession with her, and viewed her not as this living embodiment of death, but as this interest to be pursued. And so with the Infinity Gauntlet, with everything at his command, Thanos could basically easily win everything except that it's not enough for him, because what he wants is the affections of Mistress Death. And that's what sets up at least the first half of the Infinity Gauntlet story, is Thanos trying to come up with ways to impress her and failing mightily.
And here's where I'm going to make some comments that will probably earn of our good friend Tim Capel. After having reread this story and having seen Infinity War now three times, from a characterization standpoint, give me movie Thanos over comic Thanos. And the reason for that is movie Thanos, he's a hard dude, man. He is like a cold, calculating guy who is constantly acting in his own self-interest. And yes, they give him moments of vulnerability, the Gamora stuff particularly. And he has moments where he shows real emotion and loss. But he does not whine and complain nearly as much as comic Thanos. Comic Thanos follows Death around like a little bitch, essentially, for the better part of like three issues. Always whining that he can't get her attention and acting like a freaking 15-year-old with a crush. It's cool at first, and then it gets very grating by about issue two or three.
What he is, Nick, is a great heel.
Yes. In the movie, he's a Brock Lesnar heel. In the comic, he's a Ric Flair heel.
Yes.
A chicken shit.
Yes. Yes. In some ways. Yes. And I, for the record, I agree with you. I think I love them both. For me, it's a both thing. Like, I wouldn't have wanted.
I'm not saying I don't like comic Thanos. I'm saying I like movie Thanos better.
I wouldn't have wanted comic Thanos to be like movie Thanos, personally. I like the way he was. But I wouldn't movie Thanos to be Thanos. I think movie Thanos is exactly what he needs to be. And to me, to your point, Nick, I think he is a more inherently believable and immersive character. So I would agree with you on that level. But he's immensely entertaining here to me, because I love – that's the one thing, is for as similar as Thanos is – and Jim Starlin himself said the movie got Thanos exactly how he envisioned him. But – here, Thanos is much more of the cackling, arrogant, boastful villain of the comic book universe that you might expect. Whereas in the movie, everything he's doing is for a purpose. He has a single-minded purpose that he is committed to, and he's not necessarily happy about it. He's doing it because it needs to be done. In this case, Thanos takes joy and pleasure in everything that he's doing. And I agree, Nick, I love movie Thanos, and I would tend to agree that I probably like him even a little bit better, but I still love comics Thanos. And here you see him, playing games almost with his brother Eros, who has the ability, much like DC Psycho Pirate, to emotionally manipulate people. Well, the first thing Thanos does, he kidnaps his brother and removes his mouth, which removes his ability to manipulate emotions. His brother, he brings back his granddaughter Nebula, who is a wrecked, distorted mess, basically.
So if Nebula is his granddaughter, who is Nebula's parent? Who are Nebula's parents?
I have no idea. Absolutely no idea. Like I said, like you, I've never read any of the build-up to Infinity War, or Infinity Gauntlet, I should say, nor have I ever read Infinity War or Infinity Crusade, the follow-up to Infinity Gauntlet. So I have absolutely no clue the parentage of Nebula, what her past was at this point. I just know that here she's wandering around like a literal zombie with her eyeballs popping out and everything. Really disturbing artwork from both Perez and Ron Lim here on Nebula. He also brings Mistress Death so she can watch all of this, and then he grows increasingly frustrated and maddened by the fact that she won't that she rebukes his advances. And eventually, Thanos creates his own lover out of thin air. He creates Taraxia, the Terrible, and she becomes his easy lover, if you will, Nick.
Indeed, she does. He attempts to make Deathless, which is a total like adolescent move.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, you know, just adding to the things he's already done that are kind of silly, but. Greg, I just looked up. Apparently, the gimmick on Nebula at this time was that she was claiming to be a relative of Thanos because she believed Thanos was dead and that it would grant her legitimacy among the cosmic community. And that when Thanos returned, he found her claim of relation to him to be offensive and took a vendetta.
Okay, well that's interesting, and that makes me feel a little bit better because one of the points I was going to bring up, and I'll get to it now, even though it's at the end of the story. At the very end of this book, there is a sequence of events in which Nebula ends up with the Infinity Gauntlet. And Thanos comes to her to implore her to return the gauntlet to him and says, if she does, all will be forgiven. And he says, I might even consider you as my consort. Now, I thought perhaps he just means a companion, as he is talking again to what, to my knowledge, before you just told me what you did, is his granddaughter, and he refers to granddaughter. So I go to the old dictionary.com, and I type in consort. I'm a wordsmith of sorts, but I thought, well, maybe in this case I haven't smithed the right word. Here is the entry for consort, Nick. Noun. A husband or wife, spouse, especially of a reigning monarch.
Now, wait a minute. Wouldn't Taraxia already have been his consort?
Presumably, he's offering for Nebula to replace Taraxia.
Got it. I know. I got what it is. Now I understand why you love comic Thanos so much. He's clearly Mormon.
What, is he an incestuous Mormon?
No, because they're not related.
But if he refers to her as his granddaughter,
I think, or now is that an ironic
reference?
I think it's I think it's a mocking title.
I see. So, well, hey, you know what? If you got the Infinity, like, what is to say you can't have multiple consorts?
If you've got special underwear, what is to say you can't have multiple consorts?
We're not delving into that right now, but what was I going to say? Where was I going to go? You see, Nick's to Mormonism has to do with me liking the Brigham Young University Cougars.
And Utah. You like things from the state of Utah.
Yes, I like the Utah Jazz. General.
Greg thinks Utah is a magical utopia where alcohol and drugs exist.
When have I ever said that?
It's been implied.
Oh, good Lord. It's been implied. It's been inferred by a rapscallion named Nick Duke. Nonetheless, Infinity Gauntlet, like I said, Nebula ends up with it. She doesn't become Thanos' consort. But the cool thing about this story and the really, like, memorable thing to me from my childhood up today is that concept of a bad guy who the good guys just cannot beat. And I don't know why, but from a very early age, I'm fascinated by the concept of what happens when the bad guy wins. And in this case, not only does Thanos demolish the heroes, the collection of the Avengers, X-Men, pretty much every corner of the Marvel Universe bands together to fight him, to take the fight. Not only do they lose, but they know going in that they're going to lose, basically. Do they though?
I think there's a panel in there where Adam Warlock is telling the Silver Surfer that they're going to
lose. I guess the heroes don't know,
who is the orchestrator of all this, and the Silver Surfer know they're going to lose. So it's almost like Warlock is something of a douche who is just sacrificing these left and right in service of a goal without them with the larger goal is.
Warlock is using the heroes as pawns in this giant celestial chess game. He's also using the cosmic entities. We've never seen, at least I hadn't, seen anyone play the likes of Galactus and Eternity and all of these incredibly powerful, you know, on the back of the Marvel card, seven in every category or the not applicable. All of these characters getting played by Adam Warlock as pawns in his game of chess or as rooks or knights or what have you. And they go into this battle, but you as a reader, you know going in, no hope. And it's so interesting reading a story that, you know, Thanos is the ultimate nihilist, and he's referred to that multiple times in this story. And as a reader, especially as a kid, that's pretty interesting to know that this bad guy has doesn't just have the upper hand, like in the way that, oh, Dr. Doom's captured Mary Jane, he has the upper hand on or Dr. Octopus has captured Mary Jane, he has the upper hand on Spider-Man. No, this is a situation where you know Spider-Man isn't going to make it. He isn't going to win. And there's always something compelling about that to me. And so watching all of the ways that Thanos just demolishes these heroes, he buries Scarlet Witch in this cocoon. He my favorite death, actually, he takes a glass cube around the head of Cyclops and suffocates him to death. He turns some people to ribbons. He I can't remember who it is that he
turns Eric Masterson to glass and shatters. Which was awesome.
Yes. He turns somebody into these like, I believe it was Nova. He turns Nova into these, children's play cubes, as he calls them. The weird thing is how nonchalant some of the deaths are, Nick. Like, did you notice Iron Man gets beheaded in the background of a scene by Taraxia?
He does? Yeah. Oh, yeah, he does. Yeah, because then she comes up with the head
of Iron
later
Man.
Later on,
yeah.
Hands it to Thanos.
Yeah. And if you look in the background, one of the panels, you just see her ripping Iron Man's head off. And then Spider-Man gets bludgeoned to death with a rock. by Taraxia. It's just a level of violence and destruction that was rare for superhero comics, at least to my exposure as a kid, and holds up.
Ultimately, than the comic did.
I think that's fair to say, particularly in that it is obvious because of the nature of everything that happens, because it's not just that half of life is wiped out. Oh, by the way, that happens here too. Half of life is just evaporated by Thanos.
Just evaporated in literally the same fashion in the movie.
But I think that the interesting aspect is that it's not enough just to do that. You also see the entire remain, and Eros is also a point of view character that you get as well.
Two issues, essentially.
What are some of your favorite deaths in this, Nick? What are some of your action scenes in this story?
Eric Masterson, you know, just because it's always good to see that fucker get killed. Cyclops, as you mentioned earlier, with the box around his head, that was an inventive death. And then also Wolverine, who it looks like has stricken the big hero moment, the near fall on Thanos, so to speak, only to be beaten down. So many deaths. Hard to pick any in particular out, but those, would be the three that stand out the most.
Yeah, certainly great to see the Infinity Gauntlet used in creative fashion. Shall we say. Although a lot of times he does just use it to shoot energy blasts. So it's not like it's quite as inventive as I remembered it being when I was a kid in terms of his usage. But he does do some cool stuff with the deaths that we mentioned there, people turning into ribbons, turning into cubes, whatever. So that kind of segues naturally into a conversation about the art here, because the first three issues are drawn by George Perez, and then at that point he leaves and is replaced by Ron Lim.
That's a little surprising to hear you say that, because I really didn't notice much of a change in the art at all. I will say I did notice a little bit that there was more epic scope in the first three issues. You know, some of those splash pages were just really remarkable, and I think those are the things that stand out the most to me in terms of the imagery. But no, I didn't really notice a big drop off there.
Yeah, I was also I was stunned by how I didn't notice it either. Like in terms of the characters looked the same, they moved the same. I think if you go back and read it, the first three issues do pop a little bit more, particularly the first two have some of these amazing, you know, patented George Perez. Let's put two dozen characters on a page together, you know. Incredible stuff, and you get that a little bit less as the book rolls on, and some of the action scenes are a little bit less maybe inventive than you would get from Perez. But Lim does a magnificent job here. The emotion, I particularly loved how both artists did the facial expressions for Thanos, Nick. Whenever they were doing these scenes of him committing a new act with the Infinity Gauntlet, like he does something new that he thinks is going to win Death's affection, and he gets that cocky grin on his face, you know, and then he turns and then he sees her and his face kind of droops, and it goes from like happy to kind of confused to sad and then to either mad or just resigned to what's going on. I thought from both artists that was magnificent here.
Yeah, I would agree as well. I mean, just remarkable consistency across the board. So, yeah, I don't know really what else we can say about the art here.
Yeah, so let's get to the writing from Jim Starlin. Now, I haven't read as much Jim Starlin work as I would like to.
Yeah, me neither.
I've read a decent amount, I guess, but not a whole lot. And I was really, really impressed by how well this holds up. The plot is sound. The pace is great.
Yeah, it moves a little faster. 90s, it moves a little faster than we're probably accustomed to in the modern age, but not so fast as to be uncomfortable. You know what I mean? Like it's like a nice middle ground between the 70s storytelling and the modern storytelling. I really enjoyed the pace of the whole thing.
Yeah, it's like it cuts a good pace. And the dialogue, I think, is really strong for the most part. It's very late 80s, early 90s in terms of you do have your kind of stereotypical, cliched superhero dialogue from, you know, you got Captain America's kind of a cipher here. He's kind of the kind of generic, all right, gentlemen, we got to get our stuff together kind of guy. And you get some generic dialogue, like I mentioned with Doctor Strange earlier in our little joke about that. But the characters, for the most part, sound unique. The characters have their own voices, for the most part. I think the dialogue flows pretty well when you're dealing with melodramatic Shakespearean type stuff where you've got shalls and musts and everything, and, you know, Doctor Strange and Adam Warlock and Silver Surfer and Thanos, and they're all kind of talking in this bombastic style. So I thought the dialogue here was good too, Nick.
Yeah, I would agree. Like you said, a little 90s, a little bit more straightforward than we are probably accustomed to at points. But, you know, worked in service of the story, was not overly obvious. I dug it. It was all good.
And again, a key is making sure your characters don't all sound the same.
Right.
Which we've talked about before. And success in that regard here. The conclusion of the story is interesting as well, and it's one that I didn't remember very well. Thanos, as we mentioned, is kind of undone by his arrogance, by his also by this nagging internal conflict that he has. And at the end of the story, I thought that the Infinity Gauntlet was destroyed. But in fact, at the end of the story, Adam Warlock flat out takes the Infinity Gauntlet and essentially dares anyone to challenge him as the supreme being of the universe.
Yeah, which makes me wonder what the fallout of that is. Like, he didn't have the Infinity Gauntlet forever, surely.
No, certainly. So it's kind of a shocking finish here. We get... At the end of the story, Warlock goes off with Gamora and Pip the Troll, and he's going on this quest, but he hasn't told anyone what this quest exactly is, just that it's going to be perilous and he's not looking forward to it, but that how perilous can it be if he's wielding the Infinity Gauntlet? So very curious, and also there's that sense at the end that even though he didn't get what he was searching for, maybe Thanos ultimately was the winner in the end. Excellent stuff here, Nick. I don't know about you. I think this holds up really, really well. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. for me, as we did our countdown of Marvel events, for me, it's still the ultimate Marvel Comics event. I don't think that they've topped it since then. And for me, and maybe that's the nostalgia talking partially, but I feel like nothing has felt like this big of an event, no matter how hard they've hyped them since then.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really comment on where I think it ranks in the overall event pantheon. I'd have to really do some more thinking about that, but it definitely holds up. I thoroughly enjoyed this rereading, especially the art was just blow away from Perez and Lim. It did not disappoint here on this reexamination. It absolutely deserves its place in history.
Oh, one other thing I wanted to call attention to is we meet these cosmic entities here that are Galactus and Kronos and Eternity and
Living Tribunal.
Living Tribunal.
The Watcher.
The Watcher. Uatu the Watcher.
Chaos and Order.
Chaos and Order. I mean, either Lord Chaos and Master Order or Master Chaos and Lord Order. I'm never sure which, but one of them is a floating bald head.
Oh, God.
And at one point near the end, Nebula has the Infinity Gauntlet, and she is fighting back these entities and putting them through this torturous process. And you see the pained, bald expression on this individual, and I couldn't help but think of a pained Charles Xavier going, in the background when this was happening.
Was that a pained Charles Xavier or a pained Katharine Hepburn?
Can it be both?
It can be, I suppose.
Ah! No, man! Power! Oh, Lord God, I'm popping myself now.
I think we need an X-Men adaptation for comic book theater featuring Katharine Hepburn as Charles Xavier.
As Charles Xavier? I love it. I love it. Oh, God. Jane! Anyway, so with that being said, folks, we loved Infinity Gauntlet. We hope you love the Infinity Gauntlet, too. Maybe you don't. Let us know. Tell us your thoughts on this classic Marvel story. And you can do that by tweeting us. I am at gphillips8652. He is at NickDuke87. You can shoot us an email to the loneliest email addresses on the internet. GregP@placetobenation.com, NickD@placetobenation.com, or you can join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page.
Been rocking lately.
We have got we have been both rocking and rolling at the
we've been hanging and banging.
At the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, just go to Facebook, type in Place to Be Nation Comics, should be the first thing that comes up. Join the group, join the discussion, join the fun. And gosh, with all that being said, we are going to take a break here. And also would like to invite you to send us your ideas for future shows, books that you want us to look at. We just re-examined the Infinity Gauntlet. Is there another Infinity book you would like us to read and take a look at? Let us know. We've gotten a couple of great suggestions from some of our readers out there, or listeners out there, not readers. And with that being said, we're going to take a break. When we come back from the other side, we've got reading, watching, and Nick, we've got quite the rundown.
Jesus Christ, we do.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hi there. We're back, ladies and gentlemen, with the rest of the hard-traveling fanboys, the long book hunters. Our discussion of Infinity Gauntlet is over, but our discussion about comics is not over yet. Really quickly, we talked before the break about wanting to solicit feedback from the listeners, and I would like to point out Steven Stetson, who is a listener of the show. He offered some feedback to last week's show, which was our favorite active writers. Hmm. He submitted his list. His list is Warren Ellis, Jeff Lemire, Jason Aaron, Grant Morrison, your boy, Nick, and Chip Zdarsky.
Is that 5-1 or 1-5?
I believe that is 1-5. And he included honorable mentions, which we don't do, to Garth Ennis, Kelly Sue DeConnick, Brian K. Vaughan, Ed Brubaker, Matt Fraction, Brian Wood, and Jonathan Hickman. And I also thought you'd be interested, Nick, that Mr. Mark Clare was not pleased with one of your choices last week.
That was stunning to me.
Shocking, eh?
Yeah, just absolutely stunning that Mark Clare does not believe that Tom King is, in fact, killing it on Batman right now.
Nonetheless, folks, we invite even more of your feedback. We would love to hear from you and your lists. We'll try to get to them on the show if we can, but right now, we've just got too much to talk about, Nick. So we're going to start out with reading and watching.
Reading and watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Oh, such a beautiful jingle, Nick. Have you been reading anything this past week?
No.
That's it? Just no?
No.
Yeah, well, no. Don't worry. Yeah, well, neither have I. So let's just get on with that. I didn't read anything either, except the Infinity Gauntlet.
Yep. Read that.
So let's... Mm-hmm. And it's good. It's a good read. So let's move on to watching. It's all right.
It's okay.
So let's move on to watching. Now, last week, we did have a new episode of Supergirl. I am extremely behind right now on that show. Mm-hmm. I was on assignment last week, so thus,
bullshit.
I was unable to watch. I'm far behind. Nick, any brief thoughts on Supergirl? Spoiler free.
It's pretty good.
Strong words from a strong man, Captain Insano. The Flash was last week. last Tuesday night. Mm. And Nick, what can you tell us about The Flash from last week?
Did you watch The Flash from last week?
I did, but I'm having trouble remembering it.
Okay, so The Flash from last week involved Cisco and Caitlin's plan to have Barry pull them into Flash time in order to save these Argus employees from a death trap that the Thinker had set in execution of his plan to steal some sort of material that was going to enable him to power satellites that were going to set about the awakening or the enlightening.
Somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to save the employees.
Indeed they do. And so that was what the conceit of this episode was Barry trying to train Caitlin and Cisco to use second hand donated speed powers or something like that. All the meanwhile, you have Cecile, who hasn't been around in a while, finally seemingly about to give birth, and then Harry becoming consistently dumber, for a lack of a better term. So that was kind of what all was going on this episode, and I liked it. I thought it was good. It was a good little cool down before the big blow off coming, which has already aired by the time we're recording this podcast, but that we're going to review on the show next week.
It also featured an incredible action scene at the beginning where DeVoe is infiltrating Argus.
Oh, yeah, and it's David Ramsey as DeVoe, and that was outstanding, that little bit.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, seeing Diggle is always great, but he did wonderful. That action scene was phenomenal. Dumb Harry was great, I thought, Nick. I greatly enjoyed Harry just kind of not being able to understand that he wasn't helping the group much at the time. Really good stuff. So thumbs up to The Flash. And last week was the season finale of Arrow. And this was the big blow off, if you will, we've been building up to for months now of Ricardo Diaz against Team Arrow. And I thought it delivered in a huge way. I thought it was spectacular. Arrow tends to deliver, with one prominent exception, tends to deliver great season finales, and this was no exception. It was a great season finale to what's become a pretty damn good season. And the back half of it, a season that had a stretch of probably 7 to 8 good episodes in a row, really good episodes in a row. And this one featured a little bit of everything. It starts out with a killer action scene where the team is infiltrating Diaz's headquarters at the police station. I thought it was one of the best action scenes of the season. Really made Mr. Terrific look like a badass for the first time, maybe ever. And then of course, we get a lot of character moments as Oliver has made a deal with the FBI to bring them to Star City to help out against Diaz and his crew. Of course, there is a trade-off to that, and we, the audience, nor Team Arrow, knows what that trade-off is. Only Ollie knows.
Although it's hinted about a bit throughout the course of the episode as Ollie is acting a bit out of character. So
he's trying to make amends with anyone that he has wronged. Mm-hmm. And so he's going around, he's apologizing for his behavior and apologizing for any perceived slights that he's given to any of the team members, letting them know how he feels about them. Notably, except for Felicity and William, he goes around and says goodbye to everybody else. And I guess we can spoil this, Nick, because this isn't too much of a spoiler. It's been out everywhere. If you would like to not hear a spoiler, you can skip ahead probably about 5 minutes. You'll be fine. But Quentin Lance, with his final appearance on Arrow, with a pretty heartbreaking death here at the hands of Ricardo Diaz. But before he dies, we get what for me, Nick, was an all-time scene for Arrow, where Ollie and Quentin have one last heart-to-heart. Ollie thinks it's going to be their last time talking to each other for a while because of his trade-off that he's made with the FBI. Turns out being their last talk for a different reason. And I thought it was incredible. The acting here from Paul Blackthorne, from Stephen Amell, tremendous. Kirk Acevedo as Ricardo Diaz, unhinged, phenomenal, great fight scene on the rooftop with Ollie. They finally took a step towards making me care about the Black Siren redemption story. They made me care about Renee for the first time in a long time. I thought it was an excellent episode and a tremendous cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. Phenomenal stuff, which we've speculated about what they were going to do with this on the show before, and to see it actually brought into reality was pretty freaking awesome.
Yeah, I would agree. I can't wait to see where season 7 goes. It has the potential to fulfill a lot of promises that that other CW seasons have made, namely last season of The Flash, where we thought we were going to get this massive status quo change, and then we didn't. It only lasted an episode. I think this Arrow thing is going to stick a bit longer, and I'm interested to see how this goes. Not wanting to spoil too much, but should be a very, very intriguing build to season 7 of Arrow, and honestly have as much or more intrigue going into the season than pretty much anything since season 1 has had.
Yeah, the incredible amount of momentum they picked up near the end of this season helps a lot. The premise of the next season helps a lot.
They just got to find a way to get back to more of that season 5 mentality of, yeah, see, this season hit a stride down the stretch, but man, you can't have that much filler and that much, you know.
Right.
You can't backload the season that much. You got to find a way to produce a consistent season going forward.
Absolutely. I agree. And you've got to, I think the key to that is remembering who the main character is.
Mm-hmm.
And who the characters are that the fans are attached to, which are Oliver, Diggle, and Felicity. The rest of the characters are ancillary, and you can have other characters on the show, but you can't move too far from your core of Oliver Queen. And I think that what helped this back half of the season was a spectacular villain.
Mm-hmm.
In Ricardo Diaz, and to their credit, I love that they broke from the Arrow tradition and they left Diaz alive.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a great move. I'm hopeful to see him pop up in the future, potentially with the aforementioned Longbow Hunters who were introduced in Jeff Lemire's run. So should be an interesting thing to watch going forward. So not much to rank this week. Both shows were really good. I thought Arrow was just next level. So,
mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, Arrow over Flash, but, you know, just two shows to rank it. And if I were ranking all three of them, I would probably go Arrow, Supergirl, Flash. But, you know, all were very good.
Excellent. Well, let's I do have another watch. I saw Infinity War for the third time.
Goodness.
This past week. And, you know, Nick, I told you this on the phone the other day, but I keep waiting every time I watch it. I keep waiting for my opinion of it to drop, for me to go, God, I overrated this the first time I watched it. And who's to say what will happen if I watch it a year, 2 years, 3 years from now. But after this third watch, I have to say I love it just as much as I did the first time I watched it in the theater. It moves me. It entertains me just as much as the book does, Infinity Gauntlet, that we just read. I love them both. And for me, it's going to be a while, I think, before I see a movie that hits with me the way that this one has. So Infinity War continues to deliver for me every time I watch it. I thought this time one of the standouts to me was again, Chris Hemsworth, as always, Robert Downey Jr., as always. But I just become more and more impressed with Josh Brolin each viewing. I love the way he inhabits this character. He makes me believe that he's a real character, even though he's this purple-skinned alien. I invest in Thanos' story in this movie. I also invest in all of the Guardians in a way that as I mentioned after the first time I saw the movie, the Guardian stuff just pops off the screen every time. And I also now, when I go to see this film in the theater, I enjoy looking around and seeing how everybody else is reacting to it. And in that regard, I think it's an overwhelming success.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that you're still enjoying it. I have also increased my enjoyment of it each time I have seen it. So good to hear. Good to hear that we're having similar experiences with it.
Absolutely. Nick, you saw Deadpool 2. Your brief thoughts?
Oh, I did see Deadpool 2. You're right. Hilarious. Absolutely amazing. Don't want to give too much away. But basically, if you enjoyed the first movie, you will enjoy this one. It is more of the same. It is the first one taken to another level in some extents. And I will say, surprisingly emotionally affecting at times. Something that I wasn't really anticipating going in. So I would say on all fronts, big thumbs up for me.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned to me, Nick, is that gun to your head, you might actually prefer this one even to the first one.
I would, because it succeeded on that emotional investment level that I wasn't necessarily anticipating, and because, you know, David Sunday and I tend to be at odds a little bit when it comes to this, but as much as I enjoyed that first one, you know, if I pay $15 to go to the movie, I need more than an hour and 26 minutes, and this one gives you over 2 hours of entertainment. So I'm going to go with that over the hour and 26-minute version.
Also, do you know what you can get, though, in a movie that lasts less than an hour and 26 minutes?
I don't know.
You can get redheaded incestuous twins singing in a club.
You can, but that's a direct-to-DVD movie and not a theatrical movie.
True. Do you think they could make a theatrical movie out of it, out of just that premise?
Probably not. Probably not.
Spoil sport.
You were the one who turned down my Stinger Pike joke earlier.
Because it's a Stinger Pipe.
Yes, but we always said Pike because we made fun of the way he pronounced it. For God's sake, man.
I've never said Stinger Pike.
That is untrue.
I've never said it in my life.
Okay.
You're making up wild accusations at this point.
Okay. All right, fine, whatever.
Nick's getting hot under the collar, folks.
Because you're telling blatant lies to our listeners. I don't appreciate
I've
it.
Never lied to our listeners. I've never lied to our listeners once, except when I said that they won't regret listening to this show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've talked about what we've read and watched. Let's move on to the rundown.
Welcome to the
This, of course, is our weekly look at the news and notes of the comic book world. And, Nick, we got a shit ton, let's be honest here.
Oh, an absolutely – yeah, it's massive.
So let's get right starting here on the right start. What the hell am I talking about? Let's get right starting here with the comic book prices going up. That's right, DC Comics.
All right. Okay, David. Thanks. Let's get back to the, you know.
DC Comics is increasing the prices on its comic books, all of its comic books, to $3.99 from $2.99. Your thoughts, Nick?
Well, that sucks.
Yep. I ain't for it. I'm agin it. But other than that, that's a thing that's happening. I mean, there's just not much you can do about it. They're doing it. I think there are still a few books, if I'm not mistaken, that are going to be twice monthly for a little while at that $3.99 based on the August solicits. So that's going to be particularly painful for regular readers.
I would at least hope that the page count will increase to match the price increase, but we'll see.
We shall see. So from there, let's move on to a story that I know is very important to both of us, Nick, and that is the fate of DC's Young Animal line. Gerard Way, who is lead singer of one of those bands, My Chemical Romance, right? He is also the guy who spearheaded this Young Animal imprint that was kind of like replacement
for him. Fuck him.
And He's announced that Young Animal will be coming to an end, at least for now.
Aww.
Because Shade the Changing Woman, and I know your favorite book, Nick, Cave Carson has an interstellar eye.
Cybernetic.
In this case, it says...
is it not a cybernetic eye?
It was a cybernetic eye, but apparently now the book is known as an interstellar eye.
Oh, for God's sake.
And Mother Panic, they will end at issue 6, as was originally planned. He says Doom Patrol will be coming back at some point, although he's missed his deadlines so frequently on Doom Patrol that one has to wonder the status of that as well. Nick, I mean, how heartbroken are you on a scale of 1 to 10? Tony, how heartbroken are you over Young Animal not coming back?
0.
I'm going to go... -1.
I just don't care.
Which begs the question, why did we even include this? We thought we had to. We don't know why. But on good news, for people who are fans of this particular comic book, a really surprising event happened, Nick. As it turns out, Supergirl, the comic book Supergirl, has been uncancelled.
Uncancelled?
Uncancelled. But wait, there's more.
Oh, tell me more.
A new creative team has been recruited for this book. They're bringing it back, Supergirl, with its rebirth numbering of number 21. Or is it New 52 numbering? I don't know what the hell. But anyway, I think it's rebirth numbering. Anyway, Mark Andraco, who I don't know much about, and artist Kevin McGuire, who I know a lot about, will be taking over Supergirl, and it will tie closely into Brian Michael Bendis' Superman, exploring the origin of his newly introduced villain, Rogal Zar. Big surprise that this happened, Nick, and I don't think anybody saw this coming.
No, I don't think they did either. I mean, normally when you cancel a title, if you do bring the title back, it starts over with new numbering. But this is kind of picking up right where the previous volume left off. So big surprise here, and kind of shows you the buy-in that DC is putting into Brian Michael Bendis and his Superman run. And time will tell if that is a warranted level of buy-in or not.
And an interesting preview image they released as well of Supergirl holding a giant axe in what appears to be Green Lantern headquarters as Salak is at her mercy. What could cause Supergirl to attack Salak and the rest of the Lanterns in such a manner, Nick?
God only knows.
God only knows. But what God does also know is that Batwoman and Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps are both coming to an end.
Aww.
In August. DC's August 2018 solicitations revealed that Batwoman will end with August 15th, number 18. Likewise, Robert Venditti's Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps will come to an end with number 50. It is the big blow-off to everything he's been writing since he took over, or at least since Rebirth started. Now, I haven't been reading – well, I've been pulling Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, but as you know, Nick, I'm like 9 months behind. I have not been reading Batwoman at all, but I can speak to the quality of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps and know that that's a – you know, we go through this every couple of years where the future of our beloved Green Lantern title hangs in the balance. But pretty interesting stuff here, and good for Robert Venditti for turning it around on Hal Jordan.
Yeah, it's been a great run. I'm sad to see it go, which is something I never thought I would say when the run started back at the beginning of Rebirth. And honestly, I am highly concerned about the future of Hal Jordan and Green Lantern, the Green Lantern mythos as a whole. But I suppose we'll see.
Indeed, you have to hold out hope. All will be well.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see where it goes.
Hopeless, foolish idealists are holding out hope, I think.
Good gosh.
Such as certain individuals on this very podcast.
That's right. I think it could work out. I think you gotta go into it, and you gotta embrace it with open arms and hope that it goes well.
Mm.
But we'll see.
Mm. I'm gonna tell you that. News. I'm gonna tell you that whenever Chuck Austin gets his Nightwing run.
Chuck Austin. What is Chuck Austin doing these days?
I don't know. He hasn't done anything good in a long time, but it seems like a good fit.
Oh, come on. Let the record show, folks. Every person out here listening that's a hardcore comic fan, Nick Duke is comparing Grant Morrison to Chuck Austin.
Sure am. What of it?
Ridiculous.
What of it?
Absolutely
what
ridiculous.
Of it? Oh, well.
Absolutely a ridiculous take, but nonetheless.
Fine.
Nonetheless. There is good news, Nick.
Remember how Scott Snyder used to be good before he started trying to be Grant Morrison? And now trying to be Grant Morrison has kind of ruined him.
You are throwing bombs. Why are you coming in so hard on these writers?
Because fuck Grant Morrison.
Scott Snyder used to be good.
Until he started trying to be Grant Morrison, yeah.
You're just wound up, Nick. You're wound up tonight. I can tell.
I'm not wound up.
But, let's get into the DC Universe streaming service that we've talked about right here on the rundown in recent weeks, Nick. We recently got an announcement that there will be from executive producers Greg Berlanti, Jeff Johns, Jeremy Carver, and Sarah Schechter.
I don't know who those last two people are.
But all for the first two, right? Mm-hmm. A live-action Doom Patrol series debuting on the DC Universe streaming app.
I don't know anything about the Doom Patrol either.
Written by Jeremy Carver. It will take place in the same world as DC Universe's Titans series and will, quote, pick up the events of that show, which will feature an appearance by the Doom Patrol. Cyborg will also play a role in Doom Patrol. Confirmed.
Wait. Is Cyborg on Titans?
It is unclear whether Cyborg will appear on Titans, apparently.
Okay. Hold on a second, though. But Cyborg is on Doom Patrol.
Right. It says he will play a role in Doom Patrol.
Is it
right? It could be civilian identity. I don't know if it's Ray Fisher.
Okay, let's assume that it's not for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
Why then would Doom Patrol and presumably Titans be allowed to use a non-Ray Fisher version of the character of Cyborg while Arrow can't use fucking Deathstroke?
Couldn't tell you.
Stupid.
Could not tell you.
Fucking stupid.
The members of the Doom Patrol confirmed to appear in Titans are Bruno Beecher as Niles Calder.
Of course.
April Bowlby as Elastigirl.
Uh-huh.
Jake Michaels, not Jack Michaels.
Mm.
Jake Michaels as Robot Man.
Oh, yeah, Robot Man.
And Dwayne Murphy as my favorite, Negative Man.
Sure.
Negative Man's cool, actually.
I should play Negative Man one day.
You should. You've been the Negative Man on this show since we first started. Negative Man. That's good for you, Nick. I like that. That's self-awareness, Nick. That's a good quality to have.
It's good to have some self-awareness every once in a while.
That's right. I recommend buying some off of eBay.
I have so much self-awareness, I must point out that I am something of a local celebrity and kind of the shit around here.
How close are you with the local mayor?
Very close. Practically best friends. A little inside, I know.
This whole thing's so inside. I love it. We're mean. Anyway. Batwoman.
Yes.
We talked about her comic book coming to an end, right?
It is.
Well, there's good news that counteracts that bad news. Because for the very first time ever, Batwoman is coming to live action.
Hmm.
Batwoman, as confirmed by Arrow star Stephen Amell and friend of our show, Stephen Amell, will debut in the CW's Arrowverse this fall as part of a multi-show crossover event. I'm going to read you the quote from Stephen Amell, and I'm going to do it in Stephen Amell voice. We're that's Christian Bale voice. Whatever.
That is not.
We're incredibly excited to announce that we'll be doing another crossover event this fall on the CW, and we'll be introducing a new character. For the very first time appearing, we'll be fighting alongside Batwoman, which is terrific. The crossover is going to make it to air in December. I need to leave right now and start filming it. CW President Mark Pedowitz added that the city of Gotham will also be integrated into the Arrowverse.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, I know all of this warms your cockles.
Oh, it warms my cockles from the bottom of my cockles to the very top of my cockles, and that's always a good feeling to have your cockles warmed. So I'm all for this, and I would expect that I am predicting that Batwoman will be entered into a same-sex relationship with either my number one choice, who I think is actually going to be, which is Alex Danvers, or perhaps the outside possibility of Sarah Lance, and either of those would warm my cockles as well.
Well, Nick, I would be fine with quite frankly any of these scenarios happening. I think all need to be explored, primarily, of course, from an emotional standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Really getting us into these characters' headspaces, mm-hmm. their points of view, if you will. I think those are good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, television giveth, Nick, and television taketh away. So it's the great cosmic balance that Thanos talks about in the Infinity Gauntlet. Because in the cosmic balance of giving us Batwoman on live action, there is also the negative, the counteraction of that, which is that Gotham has been renewed.
Mm. But it's being canceled.
But it's being canceled.
Yes,
it's been renewed for a fifth.
It's been both renewed and canceled.
A fifth and final season. And the fourth season ends May 17th with an episode titled, Nick, No Man's Land.
God,
and then next season, the final season will be a 13-episode run, a shortened 13-episode run that will debut midway through the 2018-19 season that will be an adaptation of both No Man's Land and Scott Snyder's Zero Year.
Oh, for fuck's sake. I thought they were doing Long Halloween.
Apparently, they're doing all three.
Oh, for God's sake. Just move on.
Fuck
this show. I'm glad it's gone. And if you like it, your taste is bad.
Nick, Alfred Pennyworth is finally getting his own series.
Television series. For fuck's sake.
But it's being written and produced by the creators of Gotham. The cable network Epix, which I don't have, has ordered a live-action series based on Batman's loyal butler, Alfred Pennyworth. It will be a 10-episode first season that will be executive produced and written by Gotham showrunner Bruno Heller, but will not be connected to that show.
Who gives a fuck? Fuck Bruno Heller.
Back to Bruno Heller. Well, I'm not excited about it either. I will just say that. I don't care for this concept. I think the concept's fine of an Alfred show. The concept of an Alfred show done by the Gotham people, not so much. Although I will give them this, Nick, this small token of my appreciation. I thought of what we watched of the first season of Gotham, I thought Alfred was by far the best part. Would you agree?
I would agree with that. But then there's also, like, how do you take that and turn it into 10 full episodes? And, like, these things always follow the same trend of, like, falling into the trap of introducing characters that it makes no sense to introduce in that timeline. Like, there are going to be Batman characters introduced in this that should not exist 40 years before Bruce Wayne. And that's just, you know.
They won't be able to resist. Yeah, they won't be able to resist.
Yeah, and that's
we're going to be getting the proto, the proto Penguin and the proto Mr. Freeze. And probably, again, the proto Joker that they're not going to call the Joker.
Oh, for God's sake.
But there's good news, too. A show that I have fallen very far behind on but really enjoy, Krypton has been renewed. Krypton has been renewed for a second season on Sci-Fi. Good news all around here. I know this is one that maybe over the summer you could potentially get a chance to delve into, Nick.
I plan on it. I saw the first episode and really enjoyed it, so I'm hoping to check it out some more. Need to finish up season two of Preacher finally before season three debuts, or even after season three debuts, honestly, and then also do this one. Those are the two on my priority list. Legion, I would also like to watch. The Gifted, I would like to watch. You know, my list is ever expanding and never ending.
What about Robert Kirkman's Outcast?
No.
Any reason for that, Nick?
No.
Okay. We also have finally gotten some news, PN news even, out of HBO's Watchmen project. So Damon Lindelof, the executive producer of the upcoming Watchmen TV series, posted a lengthy letter to his personal Instagram account explaining that his series will not adapt the original Watchmen story as originally reported, nor will it be a direct sequel to the events of the original series. Instead, he calls the Watchmen pilot the, quote, New Testament to the original's Old Testament.
Doesn't that make it a sequel?
The story will feature new heroes with connections to some of the original Watchmen characters.
Doesn't that make it a sequel?
And will take place in the present day.
Doesn't that make it a sequel?
DC's current Doomsday Clock comic book series began in the early 1990s, but currently takes place in the near future of the DCEU.
And it's a sequel. I was already skeptical about this, but Damon Lindelof talking out of his ass and not fuck this guy. Fuck you. Fuck you, Lindelof.
Fuck you, Charlene. Fuck you. Oh, but there is good news to counteract it, Nick. I'm telling you, Thanos is tipping the scales for us right now. He's giving us cosmic balance.
I know where this is going. Go ahead.
While Damon Lindelof did give a little bit of a pretentious interview there that didn't make a whole lot of sense.
A little bit of a pretentious interview.
Or a letter, I should say. We got casting news.
Mm-hmm.
Here's some of the casting announcements. I'm going to let you react to them as I tell them to you, Nick.
Go ahead.
Andrew Howard.
I don't know who that is.
Adelaide Clemens.
I don't know who that is.
Louis Gossett Jr.
Oh.
Regina King.
Mm-hmm.
Don Johnson.
You go ahead.
Yes! Yes! And Tim Blake Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, George. Not the livestock. Yes! We're getting Delmar and Watchmen. Nick, come on. Put on a happy face.
But it's not Watchmen. He said that. Like, it's Watchmen in name only.
Oh, they even have names. Regina King as Angela Abraham. Louis Gossett Jr. as Old Man. Andrew Howard as Red Scare. And Adelaide Clemens as Pirate. Well, who the hell is Don Johnson playing? Who the hell is Tim Blake Nelson playing? He could be playing Delmar. Do you realize that?
I have predictions as to why. I have theories as to why those two aren't named.
What's the theory?
Tim Blake Nelson is playing Ozymandias, and Don Johnson is playing Dan Dreiberg.
What makes you say that?
Just theories. I mean, just thinking about it, he mentions a mixing of old characters and new characters, yeah, making connections to new character or to old characters, and those are two characters who were confirmed to still be both alive and on Earth at the close of the original story, and who would probably have some sort of role to play in whatever this new story is going to be. And based off of that, I can see each of those guys in those respective roles. So, because really, if you think about it, the only three that are still around would be Dreiberg, Ozymandias, and Silk Spectre 2. Other than that, Manhattan's gone, Rorschach's dead, Comedian's dead. So, yeah. that they're the only two males of that group. So that's my theory.
Could be. My question, Nick, is do you think there's a chance that either or both of them could have Southern accents?
No.
You just broke in my heart.
Now, what were those other characters that you named? Name those characters again.
Oh, why, everyone knows that those characters will be called the Old Man.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a character in RoboCop. Angela Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
Red Scare.
Mm-hmm.
And Pirate Jenny.
Oh, Jenny, not Jimmy, huh?
No, not Jimmy.
Now, because see, that would be good to hear Don Johnson refer to Jimmy, you know,
little Jimmy.
Well, that boy Jimmy, you know, down the street.
Mm. Nonetheless, also for two shows that neither of us have watched an episode of,
mm-hmm.
But one of which had a following, Lucifer and Inhumans, both canceled by their respective networks. Lucifer and Inhumans. Lucifer had a following, actually. Inhumans was, by almost any measure, a disaster from what I've read.
Yeah. So I don't care about either of these things.
Right. I know Tom Welling was on Lucifer as a villain, so perhaps he'll pop up on Supergirl next season. Who knows? Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. renewed for season 6, and it will tie into Avengers 4. I as intrigued as I am by the idea of how they tie it into all the Thanos stuff, I just feel like I'll never catch up on this show, Nick.
Yeah, I will not catch up on this show. I have no intention of catching up on this show. I used to act like I was going to one day, and then I realized I'm just not going to do it. So good for them for getting renewed. Good for those people who are still enjoying it. I you left me behind long ago.
Yes. Jake Gyllenhaal in talks to play the villain in Spider-Man Homecoming 2.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like the rumor is that he is going to play the Spider-Man villain we've never seen on the big screen, Mysterio.
Mm-hmm.
That's the rumor, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, I take it from your sounds that you're disgusted by this.
No. I am all for this. I am 100% for this. Dear Lord, please let it happen. And the underreported aspect of the story is that he is in talks to reprise his role alongside Michael Keaton's Vulture. So, yes, all of this. Fuck yes.
Yeah, it sounds great to me, too. The Vulture coming back is great. Gyllenhaal is a great actor, a really good actor anyway. And Mysterio is a character I have personally advocated for
Mysterio
since the Raimi days, actually.
Will be a fantastic cinematic villain, especially with MCU-level special effects and budget.
Yeah.
It will be next level, dude. I'm so excited for this.
Wasn't there a rumor back when we were in college that Raimi wanted to use Mysterio at some point?
I don't know that it was necessarily a rumor, but a common fan theory was that the reason that Bruce Campbell appeared in all three movies as different characters is that he was eventually going to be revealed to be Quentin Beck, a.k.a. Mysterio. So,
what a great name.
I'm all for this, man. I know a lot of people look at Mysterio's costume and they laugh at the fishbowl and stuff, but there are ways to do this without the fishbowl if you must, even though I hope they keep it. And even if they don't keep the fishbowl, his abilities themselves just lend themselves to being cinematic. It's going to be a really cool way to tell a different kind of Spider-Man story, because much like the Vulture, this is not going to be a Spider-Man villain who is going to be a physical threat to him, but it's very much going to be an emotional and mental threat to him. And I am so excited for this. And Jake Gyllenhaal has proved himself as a phenomenal actor, you know, for the last decade, essentially. So I hope this happens. I can't wait. As we all know, or as I've said many times, Spider-Man Homecoming 2 is probably my most anticipated post-Avengers 4 MCU release. Cannot wait.
I also am excited for it. And, you know, I'm not as high on Homecoming as you are, but I think the sequel has the potential to be excellent. As I said after I saw the first one, I think it's a case much like the Raimi Spider-Man, where the sequel has a chance to greatly surpass the original. And I'm excited for this, too. And let us not lose sight of the fact that Mysterio's name is Quentin Beck, which is pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of awesome, the MCU is about to have a big uptick in its female representation.
Are you saying that the female representation of the MCU is about to be embiggened?
Embiggened, that's right. A noble spirit embiggens the smallest man. And in this case, we are getting Miss Marvel. I almost called her Marvel Girl. That's not her name at all. That's Jean Grey. Miss Marvel is coming to the MCU, according to Kevin Feige. She will be introduced after Captain Marvel, who, of course, is her inspiration. Really good stuff here, Nick. Another chance for the MCU to reach a new audience.
Yeah. I mean, you've got the background of this character as a Muslim-American female. I mean, I think she's going to reach a huge demographic whenever they do introduce her. This makes a lot of sense. And I'm hoping that, you know, they've talked about various franchises they can spin off out of the Avengers. If she is enough years down the road and Homecoming follows through on its promise of eventually introducing Miles Morales, I could very easily see an adaptation of the Champions on the big screen with all of the MCU's younger heroes aligned.
Yes, and when it comes, I agree with all of that. I think it's a great chance to introduce a new generation of heroes. Kamala Khan is one of the most popular, probably the most popular young superhero creation of the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be her and Miles, right? Like, those are the two,
right?
You know, and
yeah, absolutely, yeah,
yeah.
Speaking of reaching new audiences, we are legally required by a contract that we signed with Place to Be Nation several years ago to discuss any time there is a crossover between comic books and pro wrestling. Right, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the Jim Cornette thing a while back, and we've talked about various other projects, Headlocked and different stuff. So, yeah, we have to mention this. I didn't even know this was happening, and apparently they're already putting art out for it.
Yes, there's a preview that has been released for the October 2nd release of The Comic Book Story of Professional Wrestling, a hardcore, high-flying, no-holds-barred history of the one true sport. I like that title. It's written by Aubrey Sitterson, the podcaster, and the artist is Chris Moreno. And we are promised glimpses of wrestlers including Rey Mysterio Jr., El Santo, Eddie Guerrero, Bruiser Brody, Stan
Hansen,
and maybe even Abdullah the Butcher.
What about
legend wrestler?
What about Devin Driscoll?
Devin Driscoll. Well, I don't want any of him.
Fuck you, Devin Driscoll. Never made it.
Never will.
Now, son, you will burn
in hell. But this looks like a fun little thing. I would love it if someone would send us a free copy of this to review.
Yeah.
I mean, if anyone were so inclined.
Yes.
To do that. We would never beg, Nick.
No.
Like a dog. And speaking of begging like a dog, Dark Knight Month quickly approaches. July,
yeah,
right?
July, we're doing Dark Knight Month, Tim Capel's favorite theme month of in all of hard traveling fanboy history. So I'm looking forward to that one as well.
Yes, we'll have to get Tim in. We'll have to get Todd
in.
No, that's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen. We're not going to get Tim in. I love Tim, but you know, you and I have a very specific purpose for Dark Knight Month, and that is to sit down in front of the Dark Knight films to have them slowly unzip their pants. And we will service them as they deserve to be serviced. We have no need for dissenting opinions during Dark Knight Month.
There you have it, folks. The co-host has spoken. And I think we are going to get Todd Weber on, are we not? Was that not discussed?
No, there have been no plans for guests during Dark Knight Month.
Nevertheless, we will be talking about that.
But there can be.
A lot of We also have the month of June to get through. We got a lot coming up there. We get the Haffy Awards, Nick, coming up this next week.
Yep, next week will be a very special giant size edition of the podcast as we reveal our Haffy Awards, which cover the last half of 2017 and the first half of 2018. So we have various awards to give out for print comics, comic book adaptations both on the small and large screens, as well as some of our worst categories, worst comics or comic adaptations of the year. So should be fun to check that out. And then when we come back in June, of course, we've got Hard Travelers for Hire as we move on to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. We've also got a long book hunt that was listener requested, actually, on Ed Brubaker's Daredevil, The Devil in Cell Block D. And we've also got – what else have we got?
We got an off-the-page.
Yes, an off-the-page in honor – looking at Amazing Spider-Man 2, which we are going to have as many of our compatriots on for that show as we possibly can.
Committed one Andrew Chandler, Fraser Garner.
Oh, we're going to get more than just Garner. Have to. It's going to be next level. And then also we're going to do, you know, something that we've done before back in the old column days because, you know, but we're going to kind of start, you know, not to bore you guys, but we're going to kind of start recycling some of the ideas from the columns where we think it's appropriate just because we don't think that many people read them and because it's been so long. So in honor of Father's Day, we're actually going to count down our best dads in comics for our countdown episode that month.
Mm-hmm.
See how our lists have changed, if at all, and have some good debate.
Absolutely. Maybe even some master debate.
Mm.
And with that said, folks, what else is there to do? Wait, what's this?
Oh, no.
Hawaiian noises.
Hawaiian noises?
I've got a minute on the clock right now.
Hawaiian
that
noises?
Can only mean one thing. That was a reference, Nick. That was a reference that it occurs to me you wouldn't get. It's a reference to the Dire Straits song "Money for Nothing."
Mm-mm. I'm not familiar with their placement in the classic country pantheon.
Somewhere between Tom T. Hall and Sawyer Brown.
Now, see, I know a lot. Now that's a wide gap. There's a wide gap, if I do say so.
Well, they performed in the late 70s throughout the late 80s, so I think that covers the gamut of that Tom T. Hall era through the Sawyer Brown era, right? I don't know.
I guess.
Step by step. That wasn't even Sawyer Brown, was it? Shit. It was Eddie Rabbit. Never mind. Whatever. I've got a minute on the clock. It's a wrestling minute. Let's get it on with.
Mm-hmm.
Wrestling happened this week, Nick.
Wrestling did indeed happen, but we continue to build both towards Money in the Bank for WWE and towards Dominion for New Japan Pro Wrestling, which I know you and I are particularly excited about and continue to be more excited about as the days go by.
That's right. We saw a great promo this week. Not safe for work, by the way. I made that mistake. Had to pop in the headphones real quick. Chris Jericho delivered a rather aggressive promo towards Tetsuya Naito this week.
And towards turtle.
And towards a helpless turtle. And there was a great main event on SmackDown this week. Daniel Bryan versus Jeff Hardy. Probably the standout match of the week. For me, all of that stuff's going on, Nick. A lot of happening times here in the world of pro wrestling. And I got to watch a little bit of NJPW. Zack Sabre Jr. versus Sonata. Really good match. Sabre Jr. tearing it up. Oop, and that's the minute.
Indeed.
Well, with all that being said, if you have any tips, pointers for us, let us know. If you find out anything about the employment status of Ho-Ho Loon changing, please let us know. Send it into our ticker if we can ever get this thing working again. And other than that, Nick, do you have any final messages for our loving, patient audience?
Yeah, fuck Grant Morrison.
Oh, good Lord. Good Lord, man. All right, folks, you heard it here first. Fornicate with Grant Morrison.
No, we'll see you next time. That's not what I said. That's not what I said at all. That's not what I said. I didn't say fornicate with him. I said that he deserves to be fucked by a red hot poker.
That's not what you said the first time. You're adding details to your original statement.
Well, you made it sound like something pleasant, and I wanted to clarify.
My goodness gracious, you're going to be won over by his Scottish charm. You're going to be won over by his revolutionary take on
Green Lantern. And his not at all annoying legion of fans. That's who I'm going to be won over by.
You know what your problem is, Nick?
What's that, Greg?
You just don't get it.
I just don't get it. I'm just not there. Whatever the fuck that means.
With that being said, folks, we'll see you next week for the halfies.
Mm-hmm.
And trust us, you're not going to want to miss these. Some surprising celebrity appearances, Nick.
Yes, to say the least, and including allegations of some backstage sexual run-ins that went on between various celebrities.
It's a great time, folks. Oh, we're desperately out of time, folks. Tune in next week.
Hard traveling fanboys.